Okay, quiet on set, everybody. Stand by. Roll camera. Speed. Roll sound.
Speed.
Mark it. And cue talent.
Hello, and welcome to This Week in Production. This is episode 4. I am your host, Art Aldridge. I had planned to have my co-conspirator, Tom Chartrand, from episode 2, join me again. That seemed to go pretty well, and I enjoyed it. But production work got in the way. We couldn't align the schedules, and here I am again, solo this week. A few things happened this week that I thought would make good conversation for the podcast, and I'll share them with you. The first was a rookie mistake that I've made. And I'll tell you what this mistake was after I tell you the story. So my biggest client called me up, said they had gotten a call from one of their internal clients over in the UK to do a shoot that they couldn't do. And he wanted to know if I would be interested in working with this client directly. I said, absolutely, send my info over. I'll be happy to talk to them, and we will see. The client sent me an email that explained what they were trying to do. They were looking for a single person to be interviewed by a partner of the firm, and they needed a shot at a specific time in New York at the corporate headquarters, and there was no deviation there. It was a hard in and a hard out. And it was three cameras, and they actually sent over something that I don't usually get from a corporate client, which is a creative brief. And it had framing, and it had shooting specs, and brand guidelines, and things like that. So that was helpful. And we spoke about what some of the logistics were. And I did explain that there was a bit of a challenge in this particular space, this building that's the corporate headquarters in Midtown. And the challenge was that it's a union operated freight elevator. So if you've never worked in New York, the freight elevators are like the lifeblood of everything coming in and out of the building that's not people. And in order to get access to the freight elevators, you need to be on a approved list. You need to be on a schedule for that day. And then you have to be, you know, fitted in to the elevator's queue. And there have been times when I've shot in this building before. There have been times when I've been on the loading dock lobby for 2 hours waiting to get into a freight car to go up to the floor to shoot. And it's just the nature of whatever, you know. There was construction going on. There was one elevator dedicated to the construction crew. You know, we're not maybe paying off the right people. I don't know, but we've waited quite a long time sometimes to get access to the actual elevator. So I explained that an early shoot, 8:30 was the first shot, might be a bit of a challenge, especially when we have to come in light and do all this stuff. So when I prepared the estimate, the best estimate, good, better, best, I said, okay, three cameras. We're going to use my Panasonic Varicams. We're going to use the cinema lenses that I have. We're going to have a full lighting package, a full crew, gaffer, grip, swing, audio, makeup, camera operators, DP, the whole works. And I crunched those numbers, and I said, you know, really the way that this needs to be done is to come in the day before and pre-light. And then on shoot day, since it's an early call, we'll just come in the public entrance, and we'll do the shoot, and then we'll wrap out through the freight. Seems to be less time pressure there. And if something goes wrong, it doesn't affect the schedule of getting this person in and out on a hard start and stop. The second estimate, I said, okay, if we have to come in on shoot day for whatever reason, sometimes the, you know, the space isn't available. This particular client, it's crazy because they're like strapped for space, and sometimes getting a room, even for a meeting, is almost impossible. So I didn't know that we could definitely get the room for a pre-light. So I said, okay, if we have to come in the day of the shoot, we're not going to be able to go big. We're not going to be able to risk the loading dock question about time, and we just won't, you know, have to, we won't be able to go in with the big package. So I said, let's try this. And I thought to myself, okay, if we go with the small GH5 packs that I have, the GH5 kits I talked about in episode 2, they're good because I can roll them in think tank rollers. So I don't need freight elevator. I don't need as many operators. I can forego the lighting package. This particular room has good available light. And I brought that estimate in. It was about half, or a little less than half, of what the first one was. And this we're talking about maybe $12,000 for the DSLR package. And I think the Varicam kit was closer to 30. And I sent these off with the note explaining, you know, the pros and cons of each setup. And I sent it off knowing that I wasn't going to hear because of the time change until the next day. And knowing full well we would have to start the unbelievable process of obtaining access to the loading dock, getting the insurance approvals. It's a whole process. Yeah, and even though we shoot in that building all the time, every time I go to get the approvals, it's like the first time every time, which is frustrating. Anyway, so I get a note back from the client, and it basically said, wow, that's more than we had anticipated. She said that we have budgeted $1,200. And my jaw sort of dropped, and I nearly spit my espresso. And if you know me, you know that I don't like to spit my espresso unless it's bad espresso. And this definitely wasn't bad espresso. So I was a little taken back. I sent a reply off saying the best I might be able to do is get down the smaller estimate to maybe 10,000 if I cut out a few things. I don't like to, as you might know from episode 3, I don't like to go to the discount immediately. I try to find a way to cut services or equipment or personnel to, you know, reduce the number without compromising the job. With that being said, I there was no way that I could do it for $1,200. So I sent back the note explaining the challenges, and she came back and said, well, I could push it to $1,500. And I didn't say this, though. I did feel like I wanted to. I wanted to say, well, for that, I could certainly bring in some audio and we can record a nice audio interview. But I didn't, and I said, good luck, and I hope it all goes well. And that was the last I heard of that. But what was the mistake that I made? The mistake that I made was on the first phone call, and I don't do this ever, except in this circumstance. I didn't ask for the budget guidance on the project. And of course, I wound up wasting not a lot of time, but certainly some time, and delaying their search for a solution as well. If I had simply asked, do you have a budget for this job, or what is your budget range? Because sometimes they don't want to, you know, get nailed down to a specific number. But had they even, you know, inclinated that it was going to be less than $2,000, I could have put the brakes on the whole thing right away. The reason I didn't ask was that this was an existing client that I've done lots of work for, and being that this was internally one of their clients, I assumed that there was some, you know, familiarization with the cost of doing business in New York. The second reason I didn't ask about budget was that they seemed very buttoned up. The samples that they sent, the creative brief, they certainly spent a lot of money on that production. Now, I understand they probably ganged up a bunch of interviews maybe on a couple of days and got economies of scale that way per interview. But everything that they had sent screamed, you know, they knew production. Now, that's my fault for assuming, right? When you assume, you make an ass of you and me, and that didn't work out well for me on this one. But sometimes these little questions can save a lot of time and energy being wasted. And I've gotten these calls before. I call them fishing expeditions. I've gotten them from agencies. I've gotten them from other governmental clients where they're required by law sometimes to get like two or three competitive bids. And you might be like the second or third that they just need a price. They don't tell you that. They tell you, yes, this is a job that you can do for us. But in reality, they're just price checking or trying to fill in a requirement on a form for three bids. And sometimes these are extensive bids. I mean, if you're going to do the job, you have to do your due diligence and make sure you have all the, you know, factors worked into the price. So it can take time. I've spent days working on some of these complicated jobs only to be given an email saying thanks, but no thanks. I don't like fishing expeditions, and I can usually smell them out now. And one way is just by simply asking for budget guidance. And if they don't want to share it, then they're likely to, you know, not really be serious about trying to get a competitive bid. There's no way to avoid going down those roads sometimes, especially if you're hungry for the work and you want to do the job. I mean, you can't categorically say no because it might be a competitive bid situation, but unfortunately, I don't have to chase all of those down all the time. So that was a fun little diversion in my day yesterday, and I thought I would share that with you. The second thing that happened this week in production that was a little more involved. This project was shaping up to be some drone work with a 360 camera. It was an introduction to a VR or virtual reality piece. And this was a little introductory video that was going to set up the interactivity. And the idea was a 360 camera flying around a city skyline. And I won't get into all the specifics, but we had planned to do it one way originally when we quoted the job. It wasn't supposed to be city, and it was going to be at a different level. Now, the minute you go, okay, it's going to be urban, and we're going to fly it, you know, in a populated area, the requirements of the drone and the camera change a little bit, especially from a safety standpoint. So I've got a few drones. My main drone is a DJI Inspire 2, and I also have a Mavic 2 Pro. And the Mavic 2 Pro I love, but it's not a heavy lifter, and I've seen videos where people put the GoPro Fusion or the Insta 360 camera on it, and I wasn't looking to do that. I have tested the Fusion on the Inspire 2. I prefer that aircraft just from the stability and things like that. And I have tried that with some luck. I was looking to use this newer Insta360 camera called the Insta360 Pro 2. This is a big sphere. I think it has six cameras. It's about the size of a melon. It's about three pounds. So it's not huge. It's not a huge weight for the drone. The Inspire 2 could certainly lift that. The tricky part with that camera, though, is the rigging and how do you mount it and how do you take off, and because it's too big to sit neatly underneath the landing gear. And if you did, even if you got it tucked underneath the landing gear, you would have this proximity to the top of the drone, which might not be desirable. So as we're in this sort of revised pre-production for this project, I am at the same time thinking, how am I going to mount this this camera to my drone. And it's not as easy as going to Amazon and, you know, clicking on Inspire 2, you know, drone mount for Insta360 camera, because I did try that, and not quite that easy. And I knew that it needed to be, I've seen 3D printed parts. There's a whole, obviously a whole universe of 3D printed parts now. Some are good, some are bad. I've tried a few that just were not printed right or weren't designed right. And of course, there's a fear of using something on a drone that's going to break or fail. And then you have a problem with pieces or parts or the entire rig, you know, crashing out of the sky. So that scared me a bit. So I started doing some more research, and I found some photos on Instagram. I chased down some things on eBay, and I was able to cobble together, and this is a little scary because I was able to cobble together a rig out of two different rigs from this eBay seller in China. And again, you never know what you're going to get sometimes from these eBay things. But this was all in the testing and R&D phase of the project. So I wasn't committed to anything at this point except that we were going to try to do it. And I ordered the parts. I got the parts in this week. I started assembling. Of course, they come. This was carbon fiber rods, right angle brackets, screws, bag of, you know, carbon fiber braces, like no instructions. Shows up in a basically a big poly bag. And I was like, okay, let's start playing with the Tinker Toys. So I spent the better part of a Saturday trying to assemble this rig from photos that were posted on the eBay page and a video that was on YouTube. And I was, you know, pausing frames and trying to see how the brackets were oriented. And the first pass of this rig that I assembled was very rigid. It used, like I said, these carbon fiber rods to tie the landing gear arms to a center support. And then there was a down support also out of carbon fiber with a nice little, almost like a fluid head pan tilt bracket that would allow the rod that holds the camera to be centered. And that was the part that really sold me on this particular kit, because the little fluid head piece looked really well engineered, and I thought it would be a good way to keep the camera from being tilted or skewed when it's in air. So I got all these parts assembled, got them on the drone. Then I realized, okay, well now, because I've braced the landing gear perpendicular and then downward, the landing gear is not going to be able to retract, which is fine, doesn't need to, but that was certainly a little strange. And I mounted the GoPro Fusion on it, which I own. And that was okay. It got in the air. I had to sort of put the drone up on two work tables, folding work tables that I have, so that the camera could hang in the middle without touching the ground, because the lower support bracket was probably about 12 to 16 inches, and it would hang too low with the landing gear and all that. So it was on a table hanging down the middle, and I was able to put the drone in the air. That's when it got a little fun, because the drone, the Inspire 2, with the landing gear retracted, I hadn't disabled one of the downward vision sensors. And it thought it was in contact with the ground at takeoff. And once it got in the air, it still thought it was in contact with the ground. So it actually wouldn't land. So here I am in my yard on a Saturday morning, and I have this, you know, camera hanging down from the middle of the drone, and the drone's about 12 feet in the air and it wants to climb. and I'm holding the down lift to prevent that from happening, and it doesn't care. It wants to go up. So after a few minutes of sweating that, I was able to run under it, hand grab it, and get the motors to stop. And I said, okay, that's a fail. So let's try something else. So I went back to the 3D printed parts store, and I found another bracket that would hold some of these crossbars from the first kit with a 1/4-20 screw. And I ordered those right away, paid for the extra shipping. And also at the same time decided I might as well rent the Instapro 2 and get that here so that if I do get it mounted, I will have the both the GoPro Fusion and the Instapro 2 ready to test. So another couple days go by this week, and I get the parts, I get the cameras from LensPro, and have all the pieces. I go back to the shop, and I reassemble this new mount, which is a plastic printed piece that fits underneath the body of the drone, and it has a hole for a 1/4-20 screw, almost like what goes in your cold shoe, but in reverse, inverted. And that was very solid. Didn't block the landing gear, which was a bonus. And it seemed very, very strong. I first put the Fusion on it. I flew the Fusion with no problems. Everything seemed well. So I said, okay, now we're going to go and put the big boy camera on there and give it a whirl. And I called my friend Joe, who's also a drone pilot, to assist me, because with the big camera, this big melon, the Instapro 2, you need to hand catch it to land. You could take off. I was able to take off in between the two work tables, but it's a little tight, and landing it would be really tricky, and you might damage the camera. So I knew it was going to be a hand catch situation. So I called Joe, and he came out, and we took off. We got the drone in the air about 12 feet, and the pan tilt little adapter was overloaded. I couldn't put enough tension into the adapter, and it was swinging like a pendulum. And so the drone is 12 feet in the air, and it's swinging like a grandfather clock back and forth pretty violently. And we brought it down really quick. Joe hand caught it, killed the motors, went back, and we actually took out the little piece, because it was a two-piece down rod. One section had this little panning tilt component. The other part was just a straight rod. So we took that off, went just with the straight rod into the mount, and fired the drone back up, and it took off. It seemed good for a moment, but then it started the grandfather clock pendulum, and at one point I thought the drone was going to flip over, because once it starts gaining momentum, it's almost impossible to stop it. And so we quickly grabbed the camera and killed the drone motors and got the drone and the camera down without injury to anyone. But it was a fail. And the reason I share this with you is really just, you know, I see people who are using something for the first time in front of a client on a shoot, perhaps, and it doesn't always go well. And I always prefer to do my testing and make my mistakes not in front of the client. It sounds silly, but I do think it's important to take the time to test, even if it's not a risky thing. Like, oh, hey, I'm renting a new camera. You know, why risk that for the first time in front of a client or on a paying job? I mean, even if the client's not there, but someone's paying you and something happens that you did not know about. That's a risk, and that's certainly why I test. And it, you know, something actually that occurred on this test, besides the fact that we couldn't fly the Insta360, and I don't know if you've ever used this this camera. I've used a few of these types where you have multiple SD cards and whatnot, and it turned out that the camera was very finicky about the SD cards. For one, they have to be a certain speed. Even though if you have all the right cards, sometimes it tells you that they're not fast enough. And we actually spent a good hour moving cards around, testing, trying to just get the camera to accept what was supposed to be the acceptable card. And at one point, we got it to work. We brought the drone out, hit record, and it wouldn't go because it said the cards weren't fast enough. And then we had another little problem where it uses a micro SD card for each camera, so 6 micros, and then it uses 1 SD card to record the metadata about the stabilization, and it records proxy files, small low res files of all the cameras to the SD card. And at one point, even though the SD card was in there, it wouldn't recognize the SD card. And without recognizing the SD card, it would not record. So here I am in the middle of this test. The drone's spinning. We're trying to get the camera in the air, and I can't get it in to record. And again, had that been on a real job with real money, that could have been a potential problem. And it turned out that even when we did get the camera to record, and we started recording, we took off, it only recorded for 30 seconds. And then it stopped for some unknown reason. And this happened twice in the first two tests with the big camera. So that was kind of a fail as well. And then I got the camera back, and I wanted to see what footage we had before I even knew it only went 30 seconds. And the way that you either do this is you plug the camera into a USB-C connector, and it's supposed to mount like a SMB drive, and then you import all the clips into the Stitcher. Well, that didn't work at all. I could mount the camera finally after a bunch of workarounds, but it would not see all the cards. Just like it wouldn't see the SD card in the camera, it wouldn't see the SD card connected to the computer, even though the card was there and it was working. Then, when I tried to do it the manual way, which is copy all the files locally, point the software to the directory, and do it that way, it wouldn't work. And I started going on the forums for the Insta360 Pro, and everyone was having the same problems, and I just chalked it up to bad firmware, perhaps, or, you know, really an incomplete system. So, again, just to back up my point, all of this testing, the whole thing, the whole workflow is important to do. And there could be one little piece that you were not anticipating. Yes, it should have worked, but it didn't. And maybe I would have had everything record, but then, you know, I couldn't offload it, right? That part didn't work, you know, and if that was with a paying job, that would have been embarrassing, to say the least. So I always like to test. I test sometimes multiple times, just becoming familiar with the process, the equipment, and it's important. And that's why these companies like Lens Pro To Go or Borrowed Lenses or Lens Rentals, you know, they rent all kinds of gear, and you can get something for, you know, a couple days, try it out in advance, make sure that you have the workflow down before you put yourself in front of the client. I think it's important. That concludes this week's episode. Thanks for listening. And like I said, hopefully next week we'll be back with Mr. Tom Chartrand joining us. Thank you. Have a good week. I want to encourage you to check out the Facebook group, This Week in Production. We have a closed group where you can ask questions, you can post comments. I would love to hear feedback. I welcome it. Please check it out. We also have a webpage where you can find new episodes of the podcast, thisweekinproduction.com.